So I'd like to start by thanking the organizers for inviting me to give a talk. I appreciate it. This study that I'm going to talk about grew out of a kind of investigation of different sigma models, two-dimensional sigma models that arise also in the context of ADS-CFT correspondence. But then gradually it's I realized it can be put in somehow more general context, which I essentially will be trying to present here. So it is based on these two works. Okay, so just a few words about nonlinear sigma models in general. So they entered physics via low-energy QCD, the work of Gell-Mann and Levy a long time ago. That was actually in a four-dimensional context, obviously, but the ones I will focus mainly are two-dimensional. So these sigma models were originally studied because they describe the scattering of Goldstone bosons in four dimensions. For example, pi mesons in the simplest case of SU2 times SU2 breaking to diagonal SU2. So in the case when you have just U and D quarks. These sigma models actually have very remarkable properties. So in particular, in two dimensions, they're renormalizable. So in four dimensions, they're not renormalizable. You have to, the cutoff is important at which you drop the massive modes. Again, some very general information. So sigma models in general can be viewed as a theory of maps from some surface or some space sigma to a manifold M, with a typical action of the following form. So Gij here is the metric of the space M, which is the target space. Usually the target space is supposed to be non-trivial, so some curved manifold. So this sigma model is a way of exploring the target space geometry. So then this is not the only term that you can write in your action. There is also, for example, the theta term or the Wessel-Mina-Novikov-Witten term, which in four dimensions leads to kind of quantization of certain amplitudes. The theta term is another topological term, which is the pullback of the element of the second cohomology group of your target space. And theta is just the coefficient in front of it. So that's why it's called theta term. I personally think that, sigma models are among the most beautiful and therefore useful constructions of quantum field theory, so there is a reason to study them, for their own sake as well. In two dimensions, as I said, they're renormalizable, and their renormalization group flow leads to, for example, the Ricci flow equation, also studied by mathematicians. Despite all these nice properties and interesting things about them, they also suffer from some ambiguities or some there are some issues about them, and in particular, the quantum field, as any quantum field theory, even a renormalizable one, it's there are some infinities, and they require regularization, and the best regularization is the one that preserves the biggest amount of symmetries possible. At the heart of the talk is the idea that it is natural to discretize both the source manifold sigma and the target space M, because the simplest regularizations, simplest kind of lattice regularizations, of course, discretize only the source term and just regard the targets a copy of a target manifold living on every point of the lattice sigma. Okay. And so when you discretize both sigma and M, the best thing we can do it is to investigate certain spin chain, okay? The spin chains that I will be investigating, they have, the lowest and highest energy states, or in other words, the ferromagnetic and anti-ferromagnetic vacuum. So the ferromagnetic vacuum will not be very interesting for us, because in the continuous limit, it gives some non-relativistic models, like the continuous Heisenberg ferromagnet model. There is a good deal of interesting geometry about it as well, but still, since we would like to have a relativistic model, so This is one of the main requirements, okay? So in the anti-ferromagnetic vacuum, it's more interesting from this point of view, and I will explain why. So we will expand our action around the ground state, and well, the spinons, the spin-carrying particles are the excitations of the spin chain are the particles in the sigma model, roughly speaking. So, well, essentially, this thing that I'm talking about, this method, it was introduced by Haldane in 1983. So the simplest case is just this one. So you take the simplest nearest neighbor Hamiltonian, okay, spin chain Hamiltonian, so spin-spin coupling, and you take, it is invariant, for example, with SU2 group. So, and you take a representation of spin S equals M over 2 on each side. So, this representation can be viewed as a symmetric mth power of the fundamental representation. The argument of Haldane was that the long-range correlations of the spin chain in the large spin limit, so large S or large M limits, actually we'll be mainly using the variable M later on, are described by the sigma model with target space, the S2, the sphere, and the topological term, the only topological term for the sphere, the only possible one is just proportional to the area of the sphere. But, well, the coefficient is quite important because, remember that in the path integral, this stands kind of in the exponent of the path integral. So there is an I in front of it. So there is some periodicity in theta. So, actually, the precise value is quite important. So his argument was that for this particular spin chain, theta is equal to pi m. So m can be either odd or even. So for odd m, you actually get theta equals pi, and for even m, you get zero because it's modulo 2 pi. Okay. So and the properties of the spin chain are drastically different. In these two cases, in particular, the argument was that for theta equals pi, the excitations are massless, whereas for theta equals zero, it is just the integrable model, there was some massive excitations. So, I mean, the physics of the subject crucially depends on the theta term, and we will see that actually in more generalized cases, there are many more possible theta terms that can appear, and actually it's not completely clear in the general case what the implications for the physics is. I mean, there should be some kind of periodicity as well, but so there is a mod 2 periodicity, right, in M. I mean, this implies there is a mod 2 periodicity in M, and we'll see in the general case what happens in the general case. So essentially, my goal will be to construct analogous spin chain with target space the flag manifold. So this we will call the flag manifold, okay? So of the UN group, so UN over UN1 times UNM, so the sum of N1 and M should be equal to N large, okay? And, well, essentially, I just want to start by presenting the results. So this is the suitable generalization that we find. So the Hamiltonian is no longer nearest neighbor, okay? This is the main feature. So the range of interactions is actually M minus 1, so it's related to the number of factors here, you see? And so the case of, say, the sphere or CPN just involves two factors, so then you will have nearest neighbor, okay, interactions. But in the case when you have not nearest neighbor interactions, there is also a kind of a non-trivial distribution here of this coefficient distribution, and somehow it's turns out that it's somehow completely fixed, at least in the limits that we take. The method that we will employ is we will build a path integral for the spin chain partition function and take the long range, so continuous limit, as well as a limit of like zero temperature, I mean expanding around the corresponding vacuum of the Hamiltonian, okay? And S are the generators of certain representations of UN. I mean, I will discuss in the end what representations actually enter. But they're just the generators of UN. So the scalar product of vectors actually, strictly speaking, only makes sense in for SU2, right? I mean, but in general, you should put the killing metric like kappa MN, SIM, SI plus KM. So it's just the trace of the corresponding, well, there, okay, the only invariant pairing that exists for UN. M small is the number of factors here in the quotient. So.
Is the same as n, or can be n smaller? You can choose it
randomly. Smaller than n large, you mean, or? No, it's, well, it's not related to m large, right? It should not be bigger than n large, right?
Yeah.
So, but otherwise it's just a partition of m. So you can draw a Young diagram with this n1 and m rows. So we want to build a path integral for the spin chain partition function. Why do we want to do that? Well, because it is actually convenient for the semi-classical and continuum limits, okay? And the best way to write the partition function in this case is to use the so-called coherent states, which are actually a very, very well beautiful construction. And at least for the case of simple groups, so we know coherent states. And for the case of Heisenberg algebra, this is a generalization. And for simple groups, it was investigated in particular by Berezin and Perelomov in the mid-70s. So in general, both for the Heisenberg algebra and for these simple algebras, the coherent states are just an orbit of the group. In the given representation, so you consider a representation V, take some vector in this representation, and form an orbit. Okay, so you get an infinite family of states. Parameterized well by G over H, where H is the stabilizer of W, right? And these are called coherent states, okay? They're complete, so there is a completeness formula that you can write. And they're rather convenient. So this is also true for the Heisenberg algebra. I mean, the usual ones that we know are also in orbit under the Heisenberg algebra of the vacuum, so. So the simplest example that will be relevant for us is the case of SU2, in which case the manifold of coherent states is CP1, and we take this symmetric representation that we already talked about before. So we take we realize it. We will see that all these realizations of these coherent states are built on polynomials, also in the general case. But in this particular case, we take symmetric polynomials in, two variables, and we take this vector Z1 to the power of m, and we form its orbit, okay? And we get states of this form. Okay, so they are polynomials in Z with coefficients in V. So essentially, when we form an orbit, we multiply Z1 we act on Z1 with our group, right? And so V is essentially like the column in the group matrix, so to speak. So V here belongs to CP1. I hope this is the most intimidating slide in my presentation. Really, it's just to give an idea what exactly the derivation looks like. So we want to build a path integral for the partition function like this. It's built by splitting the time segment of length beta into an infinite number of pieces, okay, and number of pieces k, then k eventually goes to infinity, so it uses this simple formula for the exponent. And then, in between every two factors of this 1 minus beta over kh, we insert the completeness relation, that's the partition of unity, so to speak, and then we get an integral of this form, okay? So these two lines are one integral, okay? So, the measure of integration is just for the case of CP1, this is the volume form on CP1. And, there are two, you see, structurally kind of different factors here. So then there is this tau factor, which is related to the Hamiltonian. So if the Hamiltonian was zero, then it would just be one, okay? And the H is the Hamiltonian written in coherent states, the one, this H that enters here. And then there are these transition factors, okay? They are really very important as well. These are the analogs of what we get in usual Heisenberg algebra. We get e to the power I pq. So these are exact analogs of that for these compact groups, okay? That was not a very pleasant formula. However, if you kind of take the limit k to infinity, you get a really nice expression of the following form. So you get a path integral of the exponent of minus the action, okay, with the following action that stands in the exponent, okay. So that here is the belongs to CPN minus one in the simplest example. In general, it may be more complicated. Flag manifolds, okay, but this is like the simplest example that we get for actually that Heisenberg spin chain, okay, and for symmetric representations at each site. So you see, we're aiming at building a generalization of this for more general situations, more general spin chains, to get a generic sigma model. The target space should be the general flag manifold. So let us have a closer look at the action, since it is interesting in its own right, actually. So first of all, the first term, okay, the kinetic term. So if you have a closer look at it, you realize it is the Keller current. So it is a pullback of a one-form J, okay, to this world line, so to speak. So it means that its derivative is the symplectic form on your CPN, so the Fubini study form, okay? So, of course, this term can also be thought of as a one-dimensional Wesselmann and Novikov-Witten term, so it can be written as an integral over a disk with this circle as a boundary, okay? So, yes, by the way, if we calculate the partition function from the derivation of the path integral, it is clear that the Zs and Z-bar should be periodic, so this is really a circle that we're talking about. Well, and then there is the potential term, right, which is the Hamiltonian, comes from the Hamiltonian. So, at least in this case, it is the angle between two vectors in Cn plus 1, or maybe cosine squared of the angle. So it is related to the angle between two vectors. So we see, therefore, that the whole object is geometric, and therefore, perhaps it is natural to study it using some geometric argumentation. So, I will just remind you some basic notions that will be used in the in what follows. So that we have the phase space. So in symplectic geometry, the main object of study is the phase space N. So it is a symplectic manifold, which means there is an closed non-degenerate two-form, okay? And for us, since we're dealing with these spin chains that have a symmetry group, we have a action of G, some group, Lie group G, which is UN in our case, on this N, okay? And then there's a moment map which maps this symplectic manifold to the Lie algebra of this group. And, there are two main properties of the moment map. So the equivariance property, which says that under, so it is a function on N, right? So it is a function of X. So you can rotate the X with the group. Then mu of X is rotated just as in the, like a joint representation. And it also generates the Hamiltonian. So this is the second property. So this is given by this equation here. You see A belongs to G. So for every element of the Lie algebra, there is a vector field which on the manifold that generates the action of this A. And, this equation is just the Hamiltonian equation. So XA is the Hamiltonian vector field corresponding to mu A, okay? So, to be clear. So the simplest case is angular momentum. So if you take N equals R6 and we take the usual rotation group that acts on, so we have three coordinates, three momenta with this symplectic form. So then the moment map is the angular momentum. So that's very common and well known. Okay, so we would like, in principle, we would like to generalize, in principle, to arbitrary representations. Suppose V is a representation of EN, because you see before I was talking about symmetric powers of the fundamental, right? So in general, for SUN, there are arbitrary Young diagrams, so how do we deal with them? So, for this case, there is this very beautiful theorem of Borel, Weil, and Bott that says that suppose V is a representation of UN with highest weight lambda, which is given by these integers lambda 1, etc., lambda n, like a vector. So it can be built on the space of, this representation can be actually constructed, or a model for this representation is a space of sections of a holomorphic fiber bundle over a flag manifold, okay? So in general case, so remember our simplest example of symmetric representations, we had CPN, right? So that meant that in those cases CPN was standing here, okay? Now here is a general flag manifold. So you have to build, there are in principle n possible line bundles on this flag manifold, and you have to build certain powers of them and tensor them, and then you get the relevant fiber bundle. Okay, just so that it becomes more clear. This is just a generalization of the fact that for SUN, say, Young diagram of this form leads to symmetric polynomials of degree m in n variables, okay? But they just have to be viewed as sections of a OM fiber bundle, but in principle, these are just symmetric polynomials of degree m in n variables. Okay, so there is a simple way to understand this, actually, fiber bundles that arise. In order to do that, we have to realize that there is an embedding of the flag manifold into a product of CPn minus 1s, n CPn minus 1s. What does it mean? It means that each CPn minus 1 is a line in CN, so Fn is the space of orthogonal lines, okay? So when we have orthogonality condition, we see that Fn is embedded by means of imposing the orthogonality condition on these vectors. And essentially, each one of these fiber bundles of one ON are just the pullbacks to Fn of the unique kind of tautological bundle on CPn, okay? So I told you that for the case of the symmetric representations, remember, in the path integral, our kinetic term was the pullback of this Frobenius study form, right? So what is this kinetic term in the general case of a general representation? So it turns out that this is the first Chern class of this line bundle that was built on the previous slide. What does it mean? It means you just have to take a linear combination with this coefficients lambda I of omega I's, where omega I's are the Frobenius study forms on these CPNs. Okay, so this is how you do it in the general case. So the pullback of this thing is exactly the kinetic term in the path integral. Now, how do we get from that back to our CPN case, for example? Well, it turns out that in special cases for special representations, the base space can be reduced. So you see, we draw a Dynkin diagram, and then we color with yellow those nodes that have this property, that the corresponding simple roots are orthogonal to the highest weight lambda. Then you, well, there is a very simple rule how you combine the U1s in the denominator of the general flag manifold. This flag manifold. So you combine some of these U1s and you get something simpler, okay? So for example, in this case you get CP3, in this case you get something else. And so there are simplifications, and of course we are interested to deal with the simplest possible situation. How do I? Yes? Well, it's like, say, if your node is colored, you combine two U1s in the denominator into U2, for example. If two consecutive nodes are colored, then you combine three U1s in the denominator into U3. So you see, like, here. And if it's not colored, then you leave it as U1. So, yes. Now I really want to pass to the kind of the main idea of the talk, okay? So this is probably the most important slide. So I just want to talk about the semiclassical picture of the antiferromagnetic vacuum. So first of all, antiferromagnetic vacuum means we should have a singlet as a main ground state. And in this approximation, we form a singlet on, say, M consecutive nodes, okay? So on each node, we have some representation like this. Okay, so we will always deal with, this is the answer to the question that was in the beginning, what representations we have on each node. So say on the first node, we have this representation. Take an example of SU7, okay? We have this representation, and then on the third node, we have this representation. So clearly the heights of these columns are picked in such a way that the sum of heights is 7, right? So in particular, the tensor product contains a singlet. And, the main statement is that geometrically it means that, to each column with n of height n, we associate a Grossmannian, Gn. So I told you that for some representations, this base space can be reduced to even like CPn or Grossmannian. So CPn is the case when you have just one box, or a horizontal row of boxes. But then if you have a vertical column of boxes, then you have a Grossmannian. So in particular, here we have G2, here we have G2, and here we have G3, okay? And the statement is that if there is a singlet, or for there to be a singlet, there should be an equivariant Lagrangian submanifold in the product, okay, with a symplectic form being the sum of symplectic forms. So in this case, it is F223. So this means there is a, in seven-dimensional space, we have the space of three tuples of objects, which the first object being a two-dimensional plane, the second object being an orthogonal two-dimensional plane, and the third object being an orthogonal three-dimensional plane. Okay, this is the flag manifold, which is like U7 over U2, U2, U3. So one can check, one can calculate as a first check the dimensions, and check it is Lagrangian, okay? By the way, I probably should make the, should just make the definition that Lagrangian means maximal null manifold. So the symplectic form, on this, when restricted to tangent vectors to this manifold is zero. Okay? So this is the main point. So this is the main point. Everything will really rotate around this fact. And I should say that for my construction, this Lagrangian submanifold will be the target space of the sigma model that I will be building. Okay, so I want to build a sigma model for generic target space. So this I need to find such product of Grassmannians into which this flag manifold can be embedded as a Lagrangian submanifold. Okay, so here is another picture. Picture of the spin chain for, well, slightly different case, okay, this coset. So you have, we have on every side, say here we have the CPN, here we have G2, here we have G2, here we have CPN, CP5, G2, G2, okay? So so essentially these two guys just mean you have to take a anti-symmetric representation with two boxes in the column, okay? So you can, of course, there is also a singlet in their tensor product, and this is more or less the first requirement of how we're going to build the spin chain. Then everything is repeated, okay, just periodically in the spin chain. So this we may call the elementary cell. Okay, so we choose, then the next thing, of course, we want to have a singlet, but we also want it to be the vacuum, right? So we have to choose the Hamiltonian in such a way that the singlet is a ground state, at least semiclassically, which is the limit we're dealing with. So this amounts to constructing a function, H, on the phase space, which has a minimum on the Lagrangian submanifold described above, right? So we're going to build a Hamiltonian. So what Hamiltonian do we choose? This is another... So let's consider the simplest example, okay? So this is another important slide which explains kind of the general logic. So in the CP1 case, for example, our Hamiltonian that was written in the one of the first slides, right, remember, in the path integral, is just this function, which is the angle, whatever, cosine squared of the angle between these vectors. So the minimum is a zero, and it is attained when these vectors are orthogonal to each other, right? So this we will call the semiclassical antiferromagnetic vacuum, okay? The space of solutions of this equation, so you should remember that Z actually lives in projective space. So the circle here is just usual scalar product, okay? Z1 plus I1 bar plus Z2 plus I2 bar. The space of solutions is CP1 again, but this is not the original CP1 in any way, or actually there were two CP1s, but it is a Lagrangian submanifold inside CP1 times CP1. Okay, so each of the CP1s is one of these Zs, and the vacuum is the Lagrangian submanifold inside it. And another important kind of conceptual thing that should be noticed is that actually this equation is equivalent to the statement that a certain moment map is zero. So the moment map is just given by this function. It is a, it takes values in SU2, the Lie algebra of SU2. And you see, if you set this to zero, this is just a partition of unity for two vectors, which in particular says that they are orthogonal. So this is the, this is equivalent to this condition. And this will actually be the general property. So the minimum of Hamiltonian will always be the zero level set of the moment map in our case. So first of all, there is yet another property of the moment map, which is important, namely that this zero-level set of the moment map is actually invariant under the action of the group, you see? So because mu is conjugated by G. So therefore, it's this mu minus 1 of 0 splits into orbits of un. In general, there are many orbits, right? But there is a particular case when mu minus 1 of 0 is a single orbit. And this is a very interesting case because there is a theorem that when up to a certain non-degeneracy condition, if mu minus 1 of 0 is a single orbit, that means that it is a Lagrangian submanifold. Okay? So this is a a fast proof that, for example, that CP1 we had before on the previous slide is a Lagrangian submanifold, because it is a single orbit. It is just CP1. In this case, under consideration, the Hamiltonian always reaches its minimum on mu minus 1 of 0 on the zero-level set of the moment map for some choice of moment map, and this zero-level set is an orbit, so it will always be Lagrangian. Okay, I just want to, so this is kind of a picture to remember what I said. I think the pointer is no longer working. Is there any other pointer? Oh, okay, it's working again. So this is the phase space N. So here's the Lagrangian submanifold L, okay? And then we have a function, I, which is, roughly speaking, the Hamiltonian, which has a minimum on L. So you see that here are the, like, the value of I is decreasing towards the Lagrangian submanifold. It's kind of fair to call this situation an equipped Lagrangian submanifold. And you see, for of course, on a symplectic manifold, we can always choose Darboux coordinates, right? dp, dq for the symplectic form. However, there is a very nice thing about the Lagrangian submanifold, that we can actually choose all the q's tangent to the Lagrangian submanifolds and all the p's normal to it, okay? This is a special case. A special property of the Lagrangian submanifold. And this is what we want to do, because then we will be expanding around it, and with respect to p's, we will only restrict ourselves to normal, to the quadratic fluctuations, okay? So this is the point. So we will expand the action around the vacuum, and the action will have the following form. So you see the kinetic term will be pq dot, because like I said, we have chosen Darboux coordinates, and the potential term will be proportional to p squared, times possibly a function of q, because, it happens like that. And if you integrate out p, you get an action quadratic and time derivatives, which is what we want to do, and which was the main point of this whole construction. Okay, you can see that in order for this to work, this precisely should be the situation that I have described. That this one, okay, that given by this picture. Okay, now I'm going to present the result. Essentially, you see, it turns out that the metric of the result is the metric of the sigma model and the theta term, okay? So there are kind of universal expressions for them. So first of all, let us build the metric in the normal directions to the Lagrangian submanifold. It is very easy to do. This is just the Hessian of this I function, okay? Because I had a minimum, right, on the Lagrangian submanifold, which means it's degenerate along the submanifold. And, we actually require that it is non-degenerate in the normal direction, okay? So it is non-degenerate in the p direction, okay? This is a requirement, but it is kind of natural, and it's always fulfilled. You don't have to do much effort to fulfill it, okay? And so then the point is that the metric on the Lagrangian submanifold, so maybe I should stress it again. The Lagrangian submanifold is the target space of our sigma model. So we need the metric on it. So the metric on it is given by this general formula. So it is the symplectic form times this inverse Hessian times the symplectic form. Okay? So this is a complete, I think, it is the unique metric that you can build in this situation. So it is a general result. So we can say that this is a canonical metric for the equipped Lagrangian submanifold. Remember, we defined that the equipped Lagrangian submanifold is the one that has this function which has a minimum on it. So you see, of course, there is some subtlety here that we have to invert this matrix, which is in general degenerate. So how come it is well defined? Just take a simple example. Take a symmetric degenerate matrix. It can also be non-degenerate, but then it's kind of a trivial statement. So B with determinant 0. So then the point is that if U and V are the two vectors, U and V are orthogonal to the kernel of B, then the matrix element U, B minus 1, V makes sense. Why is that so? Because first of all, what is B minus 1, V? Let's call it W, okay? So this W is, by definition, some vector on which when you act by B, you get V. Okay? Just multiply this by B. And so the first question is, does this equation have solutions? It does have solutions if the V vector is orthogonal to the kernel of B, right? Because just by multiplying it by a vector which is in the kernel of B, the left side is zero, and this one should be zero as well. However, if it does have, so this is why our V should be in the kernel of B, right? So if it is in the kernel, this equation has solution. So we can find W. But is it unique? It is not unique because you can add a null vector of B, right, to it. However, if you add a new vector of B, so a vector in the kernel of B, this is multiplied by U. And U is in the kernel of B. So, so it is zero. It's orthogonal to the kernel of B, so it is zero. So let us see. So in our case, of course, B is our Hessian, right? And U and V are the two vectors that are from our omega times a vector tangent to the Lagrangian submanifold. So in the case of at hand, the kernel of B is the tangent space to L, right? It is the kernel of the Hessian. It is the tangent space to L. At a given point P, but the point doesn't really matter here because we can do it pointwise, so no problem. Is the tangent space to the Lagrangian submanifold. So now suppose omega or W belongs to the tangent space to L, which is the kernel of B, and we have to prove that it is a So in our case, U and V have this form omega times U tilde, where U tilde is also in the tangent space. And then we have to prove that U and V are orthogonal to the kernel of B, which is TPL. So that they are orthogonal to W, right? So we take a scalar product, WU, which is W omega U tilde. And this is zero by the Lagrangian property, you see? So everything kind of fits together here. So in any case, even if you were unable to follow this derivation, the main point is I want to make is that the metric here is well defined. Okay, so this happens that even though some ingredients are not so well defined, this matrix element is well defined. And the second result is the theta term. Okay, so in order to build the theta term, we have to find the basis of two forms from which it is constructed. So these two forms can be built by embedding this flag manifold into a product of Grassmannians, just like we did before, okay, as a Lagrangian submanifold, similar to the embedding we discussed in the beginning of the full flag manifold, complete flag manifold to the product of CPNs. And the gradients of the theta term are just the pullbacks of the generators of the second cohomologies of these Gs, okay, which can be also viewed as the first turn class of the corresponding fiber bundle of the Grassmannian. You see, of course, these two forms on each of the G's are completely independent. However, when you pull them back, just because this is Lagrangian, F is Lagrangian, their sum is zero, okay? So in any case, the RKs are just particular known two forms. Okay, this is just a way to describe them, but they're just known. You can write them out in whatever coordinates you want. So here is the result, that the two form, that the theta term two form, given by this equation, you see, 1 over m sum k times rk. So the m here is that small m that we had before in the beginning. It is related to the number of factors in the denominator of the coset, okay? So for example, for m equals 2, we have precisely this Haldane result, that there is a mod 2 periodicity, because there is 1/2 standing here. So in our case, we find that theta is equal to 2 pi over m, because, well, these RKs are integer forms having integer periods. So now you see the interesting thing about this formula, if you look at it more closely, is that, well, first of all, it is cyclically invariant, you see. If you shift k to k plus 1, nothing changes, because this form is shifted by the sum of RKs, and this is zero, like I wrote before, you see here. This is zero. So this is cyclically invariant. This is related to the fact that we were restricting ourselves to a elementary cell of a spin chain, and we could, of course, shift the elementary cell by 1. It does not matter how we cut the spin chain into elementary cells. However, although it is invariant under cyclic permutations, it is not invariant under general permutations. And so you see, and permuting sites of a spin chain, the sites of the spin chain, gives you a different theta term. And this is interesting because essentially you have a physical description of how you get different elements of the, well, second cohomology of the manifold, right? Just permuting sites in a spin chain. Just permuting the sites in a spin chain, you can actually exhaust all the generators of this second cohomology of your flag manifold. Okay? So you have to permute the sites in every in every elementary cell and then repeat it periodically. So of course this permutation is related to the action of the while group on the Schubert cells. So the Schubert cells is another way to phrase the cohomology of N, and the while group permutes elements of this cohomology group. So essentially we have also a physical derivation of this while group, or physical manifestation of how it acts. Let's have a look at this picture again. You see this, we have the spin chain for this sigma model, okay? So here, the point is that if you permute the sites here, for example, you get a different theta term for the sigma model. In principle, you also get a different metric for the, you also get a different metric. But you also get a different theta term. So here is, let's have a look at the result again. So the goal was to construct the spin chain with target space, this flag manifold, okay? So this is the Hamiltonian that we obtained. So now I can say what the representations are actually, right, at each site. So at each site we just have this Grossmannian representation, so which is the antisymmetric representation of degree N1, et cetera, Nm. So we have M nodes. On the first node we have N1. On the second node we have N2, et cetera, Nm, okay? So just these representations. And decay are very precise factors, which are somehow fixed by our derivation. The nice thing, the interesting thing here, that it actually depends on M, but not on the partition, N1, etc., Nm. So it depends, you can choose a different, partition, but the coefficients here do not depend on it, okay? Though, of course, the representations will depend, so. The presentations at each site will depend. They are given by the partition. Okay, so so we constructed a spin chain for a sigma model with target space, a flag manifold, okay, general flag manifold, and we found universal expressions for the metric and theta term. In terms of the dates, so I would like to point out once again that there is a canonical set of data here, which is the symplectic manifold, the Lagrangian submanifold, and the function which has a minimum on it. For this data, we build a unique metric, okay? And the theta term, well, it's less unique. It depends also on the ordering of the products, right? The ordering of the sites and the spin chain. So the question is that since the theta term is 2 pi over m, is there in this case a mod m periodicity of the mass gap, right? So, because, if the theta term is zero, which is when, we symmetrize our representation, we have the width of the Young tableau is equal to M. In this case, we should have zero theta term. And in this case, we believe that, well, at least in the ultraviolet, we have an asymptotically free sigma model because it is a positive curvature manifold, right? So we may believe there are some excitations there and some massive excitations. And so is there any mod M periodicity of the mass gap? So mod M means that you can change the width of your Young tableau mod M. So you take M, 2M, 3M, is the mass gap there or not? But there are clearly many more possibilities here. So, okay, and since we have at least some spin chain regularizations of our sigma models, then of course natural question is that can we use it kind of in a practical way to do efficiently some numerical calculations? Because certainly, for the spin chains, you can certainly calculate at least some low-lying excitations and what information can you derive about the sigma model, for example, from this data. Okay, that's all I want to say. Thank you.
So in Haldane's story, there was an infinite spin limit also. So what about your case? Is there some infinite Dunkin labels limit or something?
Yes, you see, there is a Yes, strictly speaking, you see, because since we're having an semi-classical, right, so the semi-classical derivation, that's strictly speaking, for the semi-classics to be valid, of course, you should, yes, you should have an infinite spin limit, because if you just try, have a look at the path integral, which was here, so the spin is this number in the integer number in front of the action. By the way, it's quite nice because you see this is a Wessel-Zemino term and it should have quantization of the coefficient. This is related to representation theory, of course. But yes, you should have m to infinity. But you see in this, well, in the follow-up to the Haldane story was that in fact it works for all finite m's as well. At least the subsequent development showed that the presence or absence of the mass gap is actually works for any m. And in fact, there were some investigations, like I think Kennedy, Tasaki, something like this theorem that proved that there is a periodicity, for example, of the mass gap for SU2 case. So for SUN case, I don't know if it was proved or not, but it would certainly be interesting to see what it's what this semi-classical derivation implies more rigorously for finite m.
Okay, and I have another question. So can you comment about the G flows of these models? So for instance, is there just its form doesn't change? Is it protected for the flow?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, it's I haven't investigated it for these models that I obtained yet, but the general logic tells you that, well, at least, yes, it is true. So these general flag manifolds are not symmetric spaces. So in principle, there are many invariant combinations you can form there, okay, for the metric, for example. So here, well, in my case, everything only depends on a single function I. So it is a question whether this function I is just modified as a function up under renormalization or not, or you have to some extra terms pop out. So that's an important question. But and for the SU2 case, I think it was studied, in the SU2 case, these models are asymptotically free in the ultraviolet, and in the infrared, they are believed to flow to some Wessel-Zemino Novikov-Witten models. So probably something like this should be expected here as well.
Then I think I'm missing something basic. So you start with a spin chain, and then you take a continuum limit.
Yes.
And you are saying that you end up with a model which is not at the end points of the renormalization group flow? So what exactly is going on?
Yeah, I think you're right in some sense. I mean, there is this. I think the more rigorous statement would be that this sigma model lives in the same universality class with the spin chain. Well, in the infrared, they agree. So, for example, you can from the spectrum of the spin chain, you're supposed to see some spectrum of primary operators and things like this.
Can you do some classification of these models with respect to the integrability, classical or quantum?
It's a sore question. I mean, because even classically, as far as I know, the integrable ones are the symmetric space models. So the general flag manifold is only symmetric space when you have m equals to 2. So it is when you have two factors in the denominator. So in general, it is not a symmetric space, so there are many more combinations that can contribute to your currents and everything. So, at least I do not know such an example where this, for m bigger than 3, they would be integrable.